Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Andrew Muller, filling in for Robert Bound this week. On this week's show, a discussion of a spirited and audacious defence of a much, and in fairness, often justly maligned genre of music. Glam metal, which saw posses of prancing reprobates with silly hair, sillier outfits and guitars shaped unlike guitars, soundtrack the 1980s with songs about girls partying, girls, girls and partying, with occasional digressions into songs about how completely awesome being a glam metal star is. Our guest is Justin Quirk, whose new book, Nothing But a Good Time, The Spectacular Rise and Fall of Glam Metal, argues that there was actually more to it than that, even if the glam metalers themselves might not have realised as much. I think the place to start, Justin, is with a definition of the term, because glam metal is a specific thing. It's not heavy metal or speed metal or death metal or any of the other varieties of metal. So I think we need to focus, first of all, on what is glam metal and what isn't.
It's an interesting one because you would bookmark it very tightly in a way that most genres can't. It doesn't really bleed in and bleed out. It effectively starts 1983 with probably the second Motley Crue album, ends in 1991. Everything that falls within those parameters, what you're really talking about is, if I can give the listeners a sort of visual shorthand, is ugly men in layered on makeup, huge feathered up hair.
Much like yourself today.
Much like my good self, if only this was being a live stream. ludicrously shaped guitars, walls of pyrotechnics, a lot of spandex, the biggest protagonists you're talking really, Bon Jovi, Motley Crue, later Van Halen, Skid Row, those sort of bands. So that should be a sort of a thumbnail sketch for the listeners.
We'll move on to the book shortly, but before we do that, I want you to lay out a brief case for, because as I suspect will become painfully clear over the course of this interview, we have known each other a long time, and I know you to be basically what I would think of as an aesthete, a man of rarefied aesthetic sensibilities who has opinions, for all I would know, actually informed opinions about fashion and high art and such things. Glam metal seems like a slightly counterintuitive thing for you to enjoy.
I can see your point, but what I think's crucial to say about any art form is, to some degree, it doesn't matter whether you like it or not. And we'll come on to that more when we talk about the book. As for my own personal connection to it, I should say this was not done with a sense of irony or a raised eyebrow. I think the best music that emerged from this genre is up there with the best music of the last 40 years. I sincerely believe that. Now, if you want to go back to sort of why did I feel that way or why did I have this connection to it, I am of exactly the right age. So thinking, I was born in 1976. 1987, I turn 11, I start playing the guitar, you know, I sort of go off in that sense. What I realise now looking back is that 1987 is really the annus mirabilis for glam metal. So in a very short period, maybe sort of 12, 14 months, you have Def Leppard's Hysteria comes out, which is the high watermark. You know, this is like the Rosetta Stone of this stuff. You have Def Leppard's Hysteria, you have a bunch of the big Poison singles, Permanent Vacation by Aerosmith, which is a big comeback album, and crucially, Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses. So I'm wet cement for this stuff, really. I'm sort of 11 years old, bored male, living in the suburbs, looking for something that, you know, not everyone else is into. And in a 12-month period, I just get fire-hosed with the absolute best that the genre has to offer. And I think there's often something about music and culture that hits you at a very formative age, lodges in there to some degree. I mean, it's like you know, in Stand By Me, where the kid says, you know, looking back, you know, I never felt those things like I did when I was 11. You know, Jesus, did anyone? And I think there is something in that, that things... And looking back at different times in your life, you may be embarrassed by these things. You may think, that's not what I'd listen to now. But I think it's very rare that if something grabbed you to a significant degree at a formative, usually adolescent period, it's very rare that you look back and go, I can't see what the attraction was.
How far in did you get, though? Did it get full-blown sleeveless denim jacket with patches on it? Was there a mullet? Did you own a guitar shaped like a rhombus?
I did have a couple of odd-shaped guitars. I never went for the long hair, mainly because I could just never really grow it. And also, I went to a school that I think in modern terms would be described as challenging or in Special Measures, where had I turned up dressed like, you know, a roadie for Tiger Tales, I think the beating that would have rained down upon me would have been swift and merciless. So I sort of wore it on the inside, as it were.
Was there something in that? Was the very fact of it being slightly unfashionable and slightly unexpected and not the kind of thing that everybody else was at school was into, was that part of the appeal?
Oh, I think that's a huge part. I mean, I think, and again, I don't think this is uncommon. If you went back to, you know, what was the attraction in everything from, you know, being a teddy boy, being a mod, you know, being a greaser, being into glam rock in the 70s, I think there is always something in, again, a certain usually male, not exclusively, but often male mindset where you just want to sort of offend polite sensibilities. And anything which gives you that opportunity to, you know, it's something that isn't being covered in the mainstream. And this was sort of a confidence trick of the genre, though, because for all that it cultivated this air of sort of renegade outsider status, it was absolutely huge. You know, as I sort of cover in the book, this was really mainstream music, and yet it cultivated the sense of being sort of somewhere beyond the margins, because you didn't hear it on daytime radio. It wasn't covered in sort of mainstream pop magazines. You occasionally saw it on Top of the Pops, but rarely. And yet they could sell out Wembley Arena, you know, for multiple nights at a time. So it was not a small concern, but it felt like one when you bought into it.
So why go to the trouble of writing a book about it? Because as we both know, as we certainly both know by now, you have to really want to write a book about something to write a book about it. The chances of becoming wealthy and renowned as a consequence of writing a book are pretty remote. So at some point, 30 years beyond all this, you decide you want to sit down and you want to make a case for this music. Where did that come from?
Well, it was partly because you do have that 30 years distance now. And, you know, I think part of getting older is, you know, you do start reassessing your past and you'll sort of think, well, what, you know, what was the boy that shaped the man, as it were, you know, and you start looking back at these things. And that's sort of where, you know, the nostalgia industry churns on that quite generally. But in a sort of bigger level, what really interested me and gave me the impetus for the book was that there's a lot of the writing and the kind of critical cultural studies that I find interesting look very seriously at quite low culture. And there's a very good tradition of that in this country. And I think we would all accept that you can write and think very deeply about things which were not taken that seriously at the time. And, you know, you've only got to look at something like, you know, the way someone like Simon Reynolds has written about British glam rock in the 70s, or, you know, Mark Kermode's written some brilliant work about, you know, video nasties and the really kind of budget end of horror films.
Did you have to sort of restrain yourself at any point to stop from getting carried away? Because you're right about what you're saying, the work of people like my former colleague Simon Reynolds and Mark Kermode in particular, but there's always this trap, I think, occasionally of the person reading more into these works than was ever written into them.
Yes. And I think you have to be careful. You can't treat the music as a homogenous mass. I mean, there are bands in the book that I will make no case for. I don't think there are any hidden depths to Tiger Tales or, you know, Warrant or bands like this. But despite that, there's still everything happens in a certain time and a certain place for a confluence of reasons. And
so you're saying Cherry Pie is actually about a cake?
It may be. What time are we going out? Cover your ears, young listeners. But I think that's what fascinates me, is sort of saying, well, even if you, and this was a big thing I wanted to do with the book, was say, even if you despise the music, which I fully accept many of our refined listeners on Monocle may well do, I think it is difficult to the point of impossibility to talk about the culture of America in the 80s without going into this music. I just don't think you can, in the way that I think it would be very, very difficult to talk about, say, the West Coast in the 60s without looking at things like Laurel Canyon and Altamont. You know, and often the culture that is happening around the margins, when you look back, is far more revealing of the time and the place than the things which got the plaudits at the time. So, you know, if you wanted to learn about the kind of paranoia that was driving America in the late 70s, I think you would get more from looking at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre than you would from watching The Bridges of Madison County, even though one of them was by far a bigger and more celebrated film at the time.
But the story that you tell in Nothing, and I think the missing G is important, in Nothing But a Good Time, is that arc of a initially marginal movement becoming suddenly absolutely massive, which, of course, as you were saying, you don't do without tapping into something fairly fundamental that is going on at the time. So where did you get to in divining what it was about late 1980s America that gushed forth like that when Motley Crue swung their pickaxe at it?
I think it's as America leaves the 70s and goes into the 80s, I'm not going to sort of delineate quite crudely here, but I think the leitmotif of American culture in the sort of early mid to late 70s is very, very dark. It's, you know, there's a lot going on in the country at that time. You've obviously got, you know, the tail end of kind of the 60s burning out. You know, the speed at which these things happen, all the kind of key icons of the 60s die in very quick succession. You know, Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison, all these people, Jimi Hendrix, they all go very fast. You then have, you know, the country is just roiled for most of the 70s. You get a Watergate, you know, the economy is just lurching all over the place. You have these huge energy crashes. And I mean, there was that point where I came in the research, they were saying when the energy crisis hit in America and they moved daylight savings time by an hour because they couldn't light the country. And you're like, this is failing state stuff. And, you know, then it ends, obviously, in 79, you have like the Iranian Revolution, then the Iranian hostage crisis, and the country is just being pulled to pieces, and the culture that is coming out of it is very nervous, very paranoid, very inward looking, and the constant sense is something is lurking that's going to kill you. So it's basically, whether that's like The Towering Inferno, Taxi Driver, Jaws, it's this constant sense of normality could just fall to pieces at any point. And then 1980, Reagan comes in, and what takes over very, very quickly is that sort of hard truths liberalism of Jimmy Carter is swept away, and Reagan effectively replaces it with this huge sort of boosterish optimism. And then obviously, you know, the famous, you know, it's morning in America again, and there is a huge appetite for the country to hear that, but it's an appetite, and people genuinely buy into it. When you read, you know, like public opinion surveys that I was going back and looking at from 82, 83, people genuinely think the country is recovering, it's getting bigger, it's getting better.
Well, on the subject of tapping into things, he won 49 states in 1984, which you don't do unless you've tapped into something.
And people wanted to hear that. When you actually drill down into the numbers, it's not dissimilar to sort of Thatcher in some ways, where it's kind of a few quite big peaks with some real low points in between. You know, the country is still in quite a shonky state at this point. But I think what happens is people want to be told that things are bigger and better and America is growing again. And you see that across the music, which has this kind of steroidal confidence to it. You know, it's very big, but there's kind of not much under it. And then also, but then obviously in Hollywood, that becomes, you know, it's like the action film decade. And things like the growth of WWF and the wrestling. And it's really the case that I think what people want is entertainment that is essentially like the equivalent of an elephant flaring its ears up to look bigger and more menacing than it really is. And those bands deliver that in spades.
But there's still a conflict either within glam metal or between glam metal and the Reaganite revolution, because on the one hand, all those aspects of glam metal embody that. It's sort of big and it's fun and it's loud and it's confident. But because this is still basically ugly and slightly disreputable white boys from Hollywood making rock and roll, there's still something about it that troubles, well, literally the moral majority. So did it strike you that glam metal was, I'm not sure how to put it, obviously it struck a lot of rebel poses, but was it actually rebelling against anything, or was it weirdly some kind of strange echo of the Reagan Revolution?
I think a politician's answer, it's both. I think it's the echo of the Reagan thing in the early years. In the first couple of years of it, it is the American dream made flesh. You can be an ugly, unqualified, not especially talented hack from, you know, rural Indiana, and go, by pure force of will, I will move to Sunset Strip, live in a shoebox, reinvent myself, give myself a name, steal some clothes from, you know, a stripper, and I will reemerge peacock-like as, you know, Blackie Lawless or whoever. So in that sense, it's weirdly Reaganite. And you get that very strongly if you watch Penelope Spheeris's documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization. That's a really, really strong, strong thread, I think, that runs through that. Where it isn't threat, where it is rebelling, I think, is not so much in a serious way against kind of American morals, but I think it is rebelling against something older in pop music. And this, I think, is a really important point of the book, in that glam metal is profoundly juvenile. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. It is entirely, as the best rock and roll music has always been, it is entirely concerned with the things that preoccupy you when you're 15, 16, 17. And you have a part-time job that you can turn up to hungover, and it's just, is there enough money for beer this weekend, and blah, blah. Whereas the mainstream of pop music at the time is being really marked from about 84, 85 onwards by basically what you could call the baby boomers hitting divorce en masse. And this becomes the huge driving force in pop music. It's, I think, Phil Collins, Don Henley, the kind of breakup later Fleetwood Mac albums, Paul Simon's Graceland. I mean, great, fine records. You know, I'd make a lot of defence for them, but they are the concerns of someone who's hitting middle age. Now, you could say what you like about Poison. they are never going to talk to you about how, you know, their divorce is not working out. They had a condom vending machine on their tour bus. You know, they're not going to try and talk to you about, you know, how they had to see their son for an access visit that weekend and life hasn't really panned out the way I wanted it to. So if you're 16, there is clearly more for you in that, in a music that espouses that mindset, than there is in The Boys of Summer by Don Henley.
When you revisited a lot of these records, though, and I don't know how much of your time you've usually spent listening to Poison before you started researching the book, although, of course, they are the band from which you cribbed the title, if I recall rightly. But you're quite right in that this music tapped exclusively into a sweaty, spotty 15-year-old boy's view of the world. And obviously, 15-year-old boys are just awful, and really shouldn't be allowed out, probably not just then, but for about at least another 25 years. When you listen to the records now, is there any amount of squeamishness? Because the worldview that many of them articulate, I'll call it unreconstructed somewhat?
There was actually less than you would think. There are definitely a few songs where you go, I can see why we don't hear that one, or, you know, played on classic rock radio anymore. You know, vis-a-vis, you know, the younger end of women and, you know, the thing. What it doesn't have is there's very, very little in it which is actively misogynistic, you know, homophobic, racist, whatever. Because in a way, those things just didn't factor into the worldview. It was such a sort of white, straight, homogenous scene.
Because this is what I ended up thinking reading the book and thinking about some of those records, or as much as I could stand to, that weirdly, and I think this applies to AC/DC as well, a band about whom we very much agree, that there's actually a kind of innocence to it, and it's kind of a knowing innocence.
And it's sort of written, even when they're talking about women, it's always, back to my point of it being a sort of juvenile perspective, it always slightly feels like it's being written by someone who's met very few actual real women or interacted with them in any way. I think also, and to your point about how the music changed over the course of that decade, what I think is interesting, when you look at, say, Appetite for Destruction, which I think, you know, the first Guns N' Roses album, which I think most listeners would be familiar with, that is a genuinely horrible album. There is a real genuine sort of bleak malevolence to that, and I don't think it's a pose. And the more you read about, you know, their lives and their upbringing, they were genuinely very damaged people who had come out of a very damaged environment. But what I think is interesting is you have to make a judgment call on that album, which has some appalling lyrics and appalling sentiments espouse. You probably have to make the same judgment call that you would make about what someone like NWA were doing in the same city, probably 5 miles away at exactly the same time. We'd say, to what degree is this music glorifying and sort of magnifying this behaviour and these attitudes? And to what extent is it just dispassionately documenting what is going on around them? And I think, I sort of oscillate on it a bit, but I think with Guns N' Roses, I think I would say Appetite for Destruction is a very, very accurate documentation of a really horrible time in LA where, you know, AIDS was rampant, the crack epidemic was really starting up. I mean, when you look back to the murder rate for LA in like 87, 88, it's absolutely horrific. Huge levels of mental health problems, homelessness is going through the roof again. And I think I can see why the album sounds the way it did.
Guns N' Roses do occupy quite a crucial role in your narrative, that album in particular, because it sort of, on the one hand, doesn't feel like a glam metal record, because it's not an innocent, cheerful, good-timey record, as you were just pointing out. But it's also, I think, by an order of magnitude, several times better than almost any of the albums the rest of that peer group constructed. So Guns N' Roses come along with this record, which is better than anybody else's record, and they kind of destroy the entire genre.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute point. I think the common shorthand about this stuff has always been Nirvana arrived in 1991 and, you know, grunge ends glam metal. I think your point is absolutely spot on. I think actually that album coming out in 1987, Appetite for Destruction, doesn't kill glam overnight, but it gives it, it's like a leaking boiler at that point. Mm. Because partly it makes everything else sound very, very tame and sort of unserious in a way that it didn't previously. It makes everything sound very flippant, but also they despise that scene themselves. So they're sort of a kind of grenade thrown into the middle of it, in that, you know, they don't want to be associated with that scene. And you see that in the way that, even in photos, like the way they transform from sort of like 86 to 87, the hair gets a lot smaller, you know, they're wearing like t-shirts for old punk bands and NWA, yet they're obviously, they're actively trying to move away from what Motley Crue are doing or what Poison are doing, and are very vocal about doing that. So I think as much as they're the sort of high watermark of the genre, they're also what gives it a kind of fatal flesh wound at that point.
You're quite right as well that whether it was Guns N' Roses or Nirvana that did it, glam metal, as you're writing about it, the period pretty much ends in 1991, which, Lord help us, is nearly 30 years ago. Since then, where do you still see its influence? Did it just burn brightly and stupidly for the better part of a decade and then vanish? Or do you occasionally catch the odd whiff of Wasp or Twisted Sister as you're listening to newer music?
Not really. I mean, there is still a revival scene of these bands. You know, if you are minded to, you can go and see whatever is now legally allowed to trade as LA Guns. And I suspect there's several different versions of it on, you know, playing at State Farms in Missouri or somewhere, but which didn't really interest me. I think 1991 is a really interesting dividing line, I think, across music generally. And my sort of meta theory about all this is that glam metal sounds and looks the way it did because it was a pile up at the end of 40 years of guitar music. Mm. It has elements from things that have come before it from the early, you know, from like vaudeville, cowboy music, kind of Dust Bowl music, 70s glam rock, stadium rock. I think I'll sort of describe it in the book. It's almost like imagining all this stuff just being fed into a trash compactor, and it's kind of what comes out at the end. After 1991, I think the real line in the sand is that music develops a sense of kind of dramatic irony. And Nirvana's whole thing and grunge's whole thing is that everything kind of comes with quote marks around it. And the thing with glam metal is that it was ridiculous, but it was sincere. And you could make the case that, you know, a lot of older music that's very good is, you know, it takes being ridiculous very seriously, but it's all on the surface. There's no hidden depths, really. And this, I think, more than anything, is what makes it look very dated. So older bands who had a sense of irony, you know, a new band could arrive now, or you could show a 16-year-old Talking Heads or Blondie or Television, and they'd go, okay, I get it. I understand what they're doing. They're very clever. They're operating in certain ways. I don't think that would work if you showed them Wasp or Motley Crue. And the thing is, if you saw a band now who were dressed like, you know, Van Halen in 1983, you would assume it was a joke. Nobody assumed it was a joke at the time. You know, Van Halen and Motley Crue dressed the way they did because they thought it looked good. And I think that is what kind of locks it in the past in a way. And I think the problem that, yeah, in the same way that if you see a load of blokes who are dressed like, you know, greasers or like rock, you know, rockabilly fans. Like, it looks kind of anachronistic. Mm. And you're like, is this a stunt from a Katy Perry video or something? I don't know. So I think it's very, very difficult for it. It was very difficult for it to kind of move on into the 90s, because I think that introduction of irony, and irony becoming the kind of dominant note of our cultural language, was just not compatible with the people who released Mental Health brackets Bang Your Head.
we are coming to the end of our time, so I did want you, I did want to give you the chance to try and interest our listeners not just in your book but in the music it writes about. And what I want you to do is recommend a glam metal album for everyone to go away and listen to, but I'm going to impose a couple of rules. You can't name Appetite for Destruction, because that's just too easy, and it's an easy way out.
It's canon.
It's canon. It's a great, great album, and whether you like glam metal or not, it's just one of those records. I'm also going to strike off Pyromania, which I Def Leppard's Enormo hit the pet sounds, if you will, of glam metal.
Are we also striking off Hysteria?
Sorry, that was probably the one I meant. Yeah. But also, we're striking off Def Leppard, because okay, it's too easy, and also everybody will have heard all of that stuff. So is there a glam metal album that you would, in all sincerity, recommend people go and listen to, hand on heart, and say, no, seriously, this is good?
Well, I can recommend one from each end period. So first one, I'd say the first Wasp album, just called Wasp from 1984. More than anyone, I think they bridged the gap between British glam rock in the 70s, so the very best end of sort of like Mark Bolan, Diamond Dogs era Bowie.
Because that is really where the whole glam metal thing begins, strangely, isn't it?
Although those
acts never quite took off in the States themselves.
They never really landed in the States, but it was a bit like the Warhol Velvet Underground thing, where there was probably, you know, 200 kids in America who understood what, you know, Mark Bolan was doing, and they all went and formed bands. I mean, much more significant from the 70s are Kiss, who are essentially British glam with all the androgyny and uncomfortable stuff taken out. It's, you know, Kiss is basically Mark Bolan for people who don't read many books, or any books at all. So, but I would say the first Wasp album, so Blackie Lawless, who was the frontman of Wasp, is a really, really interesting character, because he was old by the standards of glam metal. He'd been kind of hacking around since like the late 70s with sort of the remnants of like the New York Dolls and Killer Kane and various members of the Stooges and things, trying to get this thing going to little or no avail. And then in about 82, 83, it all just comes together, and he works out how you can kind of turbocharge that kind of rhythm of British glam rock into something much more LA sounding. Brilliant songs, incredible voice. He's still playing live now. I saw him last year. He is absolutely phenomenal still. The voice sounds exactly as it did then. The hair is also suspiciously similar, but who knows? And then from the end of the genre, I would say...
It has been my observation that the status of being a rock star is a remarkable cure for male pattern baldness.
Just look at Saxon. But, and from the end of it, the ones who got in just under the wire, I would say the first Skid Row album. Skid Row, who were the sort of protégés of Bon Jovi, fell out with them very badly over sort of, you know, contractual stuff, publishing. But their first album, probably the last really great album that came out in the glam era, I think 1989, it's of its time, but it absolutely slams. I would recommend that.
Justin Quirk, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That brings us to the end of today's show. Justin Quirk's new book, Nothing But a Good Time, is out now, published by Unbound. Monocle on Culture is produced by Holly Fisher. Join us at the same time next week. But until then, from me, Andrew Muller, thank you for tuning in.